please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Brian from New York.
Hi, everybody. I'm Brian. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm cooking with a lot of gratitude. So I'm really, really glad to be here. And I'm a big fan of this meeting from the website. Although I was here in December where I met Dave and my sponsor, Jim, spoke at that time. And so I've listened to many of the qualifications, and I was asking Dave beforehand about, I said, who handles this? He said, oh, Eric handles that. So a nod to Eric, wherever Eric is, if he's here tonight. Hey, cool, thanks. No, it's not Eric. Anyway, my home group is called Room for Improvement in Lower Manhattan. We meet there 5 times a week from 7:30 to 8:30 in the morning. And on the weekends, we meet around the corner at a local place called Hotspurs. And it's a very solution-oriented meeting, literature-based. We have a big book meeting on Monday mornings. We have a beginner's meeting on Tuesdays. Wednesdays is a topic meeting, and we have an anniversary meeting at the end of that the month on Wednesdays. Thursdays is the promises meeting. Friday is a step or tradition meeting. I feel really lucky that that AA and I came together when it did. It saved my life, and that's no kidding. So I'm going to try and tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I also, as I mentioned, with sponsorship, I feel very fortunate that I'm in a river of sponsorship. I have a terrific sponsor. He has a great sponsor, and he has a great sponsor. And then I have a bunch of guys that I've been working with for many years, and they interchange depending on life circumstances and all that sort of stuff. I grew up about an hour from here in Lower Bucks County, and that's where I had my first drink. My dad was in the liquor business, and so we had it around the house all the time. We had pallets of it in the basement, and of course, never noticed it. My parents were very conscious of making us aware, my sister and I, that we should be very grateful for the liquor business because it provided us with vacations and furniture and all that stuff. And so I was grateful to the liquor business at that time. My father was a heavy drinker. He was a World War II veteran, and there's a lot to talk about there. But it set things into motion. He's in the booze business. He's a drinker. My parents like to socialize a lot, and something I'll come to later, which was the structure in our house in the house was a little off, and so boundaries were, you know, changed daily, and so it wasn't unusual to be, the demand would be home at 5 o'clock for dinner, and then come home and everybody's drinking, and it would be like, here's $5, take your sister and go get pizza or something, but just go, you know. And I live with that. That was life as I knew it. As I got to adolescence, and I must say, I think as a kid growing up, I experienced life as like one sort of slam after another. You know, next thing you know, I was in a pool trying to figure out how to swim, or I was in a schoolyard trying to fend off three guys that wanted to kick my butt or something like that. And so I always felt like I was just running into one wall of piece of life that I did not understand, or I was creating problems that I didn't know how I created them. And so life just looked really, 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 really tough. There were moments of clarity, moments of beauty, whatever, that revealed themselves from time to time. But I wouldn't really appreciate that until much later. And I'll come back to that, hopefully. I'd like to talk about the steps a little bit before I get out of here tonight. So I picked up my first drink around age 14. It was really with friends. We were going to a dance, and the voices in the front of my head were all the loud, rational voices saying, this is a great idea, you're going to have a great time, you know, you've seen what it does with the other guys, let's go. And the quietest voice in the back was saying, nah, not a good idea, no, don't do this. Well, you know, I needless to say, I picked up, I drank wine that night or something like that. And I felt like I got a license to live like I had never had before. I felt like I had a freedom. I felt like I could read you the promises from the ninth step and say, that's what I started to feel like when I started to drink. I was experiencing peace in a different way, less fear. I started connecting with people more and more. And so drinking really worked for me. Now, I went through high school like that, and I was a terrible student. I had some, learning, reading problems. And this was in the 60s. So when I got out of high school, this was in 1967, the war was raging in Vietnam. And I was not going to college. That was not in the cards for me at that time. So I started working, and I really liked it. And I loved what was happening at that time in music and the culture and everything like that. And I was free to drink. I was a big kid. I got away with getting into bars in New Jersey and that kind of thing. And I was working at a record store. And then, bingo, within about a year, I guess, I got a letter that said, excuse me, we're the federal government, and you're going to be going to the Vietnam War very shortly. And they didn't say the war, but they said you're basically going into the Army. So I went into the Army, and it wasn't a popular thing to do at the time. But I also, you know, I was just kind of grooving on life and drinking, having beer every night and stuff like that. And so I felt like my life was being interrupted, but it didn't feel like the end of the world. And I think because of my father, I went, okay, I'll go. So I went into the service, and one of the surprises of going into the Army was I was put into a structure which had been lacking at home and which I, of course, didn't pay attention to in school. But this was the structure that, you know, had a lot to do with life and death. And also they weren't sponsors, believe me. But the drill sergeants who, you know, you might want to call sponsors were very serious about their jobs, and they took me very seriously, and I had better take them very seriously, and I did. What surprised me was that it was a structure that I would thrive in. And, you know, I'm drafted, 19 years old, and all of a sudden I'm in this major league structure that has a lot of rules and a lot of authority around it, and I, who have and can still have issues with authority, was surprised to see how I would flourish in this environment. So I learned I had leadership skills, and I did very well. It was the first time I really, really excelled at something. So I go to Vietnam, and the war was a very challenging experience, to put it mildly. There were three phases for me. The first was total terror and fear. The second phase was lots of boredom with some terrifying moments. And then the last third of it was back to terrifying and fear-based and all that stuff. And I didn't really drink over there. I was a non-commissioned officer. I made rank very quickly, and I was given a lot of responsibility. And a lot of that responsibility had to do with the guys that I had to look after. And I took that very seriously. So I did that. I got on the other side of that. I got home, and then I was basically daily drinking for almost another year, I guess. And there was a lot of problems. I was at the height of, one of the heights of my drinking, and which was every day. There was a lot of violence, I got into trouble. I guess I was back. I think I was back from Vietnam like 2 weeks, and I wasn't technically 21. I was going to be 21 in a month or something, and I had a military ID, which I would very confidently pull out when someone asked me for ID, because in those days the only thing that had a picture on it was a military ID. If you pulled out a military ID and flashed it in front of somebody confidently like I did, they go, "Oh, he's 20. He's old enough to drink. You know, big guy like that. Yeah, what do you want, son?" And so I go into this place, and I wave my military ID, and he takes a very close look at it, because on the other side is the exact date, and he sees that I'm not quite 21, so he throws it at me, and boom, I went after him, and he had his boys, and they kicked my butt, to put it mildly, although I think I scared the hell out of them. And I know I blacked out through some of it. When I was, next thing I know, I was sitting in the back of a car in handcuffs, and this was one of the angels that walk among us, the state trooper, basically said, when did you get back? And I said, a couple weeks ago or something like that. And he said, I'm going to tell you what. He says, if you listen to me and do what I tell you to do, I'll get you a disorderly conduct charge and not the assault and battery and all the other stuff that I could hit you with. And I said, okay, whatever you say, you know. So I had to go back like a week later and apologize to the owner. I had to pay a couple $100, and which was a lot of money back then for me. Anyway, I did all that, and I didn't do it. I didn't have like a program like Alcoholics Anonymous to guide me, but I did have this man who, I think, I'm just guessing, I think he was a Korean War veteran, and I think he just understood in that moment, and he did what he did, and I was wise enough to listen to him. So, in the meantime, at this time, I was cultivating a lot of X-rated people in my life, and I was really excited by any danger I could get into. I didn't care. I think there was a whole layer of myself that was numb to life. And so when I got to I got to that point where there was this sort of convergence of homicide, suicide, and I tell you the truth, I didn't even know how scared I was because I was so crazy. And it's a miracle I got out of the Army without any other problems. I was supposed to pick up a medal at a parade, and I didn't show up, so they wouldn't give me the medal. And I didn't care at that time. I actually picked that medal up about 5 years ago. Anyway, yeah, that wasn't. Anyway, that was a surprise. Anyway, so I go to college. I decide I'm going to go to college because I'd been in the service with these guys who went to college, and they just didn't impress me. You know, it's like, that guy went to college, you know, and he's asking me what to do. I said, okay, so I decide I'm going to try college. Another angel among us comes in and straightens out my reading problem. And then I was unleashed, and I started to become an achiever. I thought, if I can apply the discipline I had in the service and enough willingness that, you know, I think I could make this happen. So I did. I started I was a good student, and it was at Bucks County Community College. And then in my second year, I took a theater class, and the next thing you know, I felt like my passion for excellence was ignited further. So I became a theater major, and I that's what I do. I'm an actor, filmmaker. I work in theater and film today, and have now for 30-plus years. But I didn't know that I had some obstacles in front of me. I went through that part of college. I transferred over to Rider University. I got into a special program at Princeton, and I finished in 75 with flying colors, and I was really impressed with myself. And I thought I was, I had a little bit of big shotism. So I thought, yeah, I did the Army, I did college, you know, it's time to live. And so I go up to New York, and all through college, I didn't drink very much. At all. I didn't have time. I was working two jobs. The GI Bill wasn't worth much back then. And I got through college, and I got through debt-free, and I was really proud of that, too. So I go to New York. Within, I'd say, a couple of weeks, I was back to daily drinking like I was when I got back from Vietnam. And it really surprised me. It caught me. I thought, whoa, what's this? I didn't come to New York just to be a drinker, you know. But I worked in bars. I liked bars. I liked the activity in bars. And I wanted to basically live in bars. And that's what I did. So I made my living. And all my playtime were in bars in New York City. And that's what I did for a couple of years. The I don't know if you would call it a divine intervention, but it was an intervention of sorts, was that in 1978, I started to have nightmares about the war, which I thought I'd put that on the shelf and was done with it. And sure enough, I really thought I was back in a place that was worse than where I was in the sort of homicide-suicide arena. I got help. And I think I learned how to ask for help a little bit in college. It was a big deal for me to ask for help like that, but I did. And I think in this instance, I knew I had to ask for some kind of help again. So I went and I got counseling with this guy who was a psychoanalyst he'd been in the Marines and he taught at Columbia University. I thought, oh yeah, the military college, yeah, good. Okay, let me give this guy a shot. So I go to my first session and he says to me, excuse me, have you been drinking? I said, no, what makes you say that? He goes, well, you know, I smelled something, you know. I said, oh, I had a couple of Budweisers, then a couple of Sambucas with lunch, but that's not drinking. And he said, no, that's drinking. You know, I said, no, what I did last night, that was drinking. And we had this debate about what drinking was or was not. And next thing you know, he says to me, I'm not going to work with you unless you go to AA. AA? I'm not going there. That's where all the bums go or something like that. And he said, well, think about it. And then I managed to talk him out of that declaration. And I said, listen, we work on my problems because I have evidence. Because I went to college and, I'm not going to be. You'll see, we'll solve my problems and I won't be drinking. And he said, well, all right, let's try. We'll try it for a while. So we do. And like that, my drinking starts to ebb. I'm thinking, yeah, I was right. Jeez. Well, I worked with this guy for a while. We did some really amazing one-on-one work. I was in his group therapy. A lot of stuff got taken care of and addressed in new ways I never would have imagined with my family, with the war. And little did I know that I had really just scratched the surface. Because my life did get better. I got into my relationships changed. I got out of the bars. I started working in my chosen field finally. And in my chosen field, I wasn't making the money I was making in the bars. So I was painting apartments or putting up sheetrock. And I started getting work. And it was about 3 or 4 years of this. And then I got into a hit show. And the next thing I knew, I was drinking pretty much every night. And this went on for almost a year. And in the meantime, my wife had sort of, she just put the brakes on. She was like, whoa, this is nuts. And we got to a place where we had a break in the summer where we were going to go from New York to London. And I thought, well, this is it. I'm just going to quit. I've stopped before. I'll just stop again. So I stopped. And we go to London. And I was detoxing, and I didn't know what detoxing was. All I know is that I was scaring the crap out of the producers and our director. And so it was like, what happened to that guy? He's nuts. And so I, you know, but basically I was an alcoholic without a program and without a drink. And that's the station of life I was at that time. So we get through that, and for the next 3 years or so, until 1988. My sober date is November 19th, 1988. Up until that time, I could put together 3 or 4 months without having a drink. But I was white-knuckling it more and more and more to get through that. And I was also doing more and more destructive stuff, especially in my work, in my field. I was hurting relationships left and right. Anyway, I ended up getting to a place where, actually, I went my first meeting, AA meeting, was the year before I came in the program. I was up in Canada working with some guys from California on this TV movie, and some of them were going to AA and some of them were going to the bars, and then I would go just sort of sit in my hotel room and, just sort of grind my way through the evening. And this guy he said to me, are you a friend of Bill's? And I knew what that meant, you know. I said, no, not me. He said, but you don't drink. I said, yeah. I said, I tried AA, but it's not for me. And he said, oh, okay. So he comes into town. This is like a month after we'd worked together in the fall of 87. And he says, Let's have some dinner. I said, okay, great. He goes, well, meet me at the meeting on 79th Street. I said, sure, yeah, I'll come by. Yeah, when you're done there, we'll go out to dinner or something like that. So I get there, and the meeting hasn't started. And he's taking me into the meeting. And I find myself walking into my first AA meeting. And he says, but you've been to AA before, right? And I said, yeah. And I hadn't been to AA ever. You know, I didn't know what I was going into. And I went in and I sat in. And it was a meeting almost this size. It was a big meeting. And I was so freaked out by people saying, hey, hi, so-and-so, hi, so-and-so. And the whole room would chant, hello. And the holding hands, all of it just really freaked me out. I was sitting there and I was going, oh my God, what are they going to do next here? You know, and plus it looks like they don't screen anybody at the door. You know, just they list that anybody can come in here. And and they make the speaker put a dollar in, you know, shouldn't he be free? Or I don't know. It was a very silly rationale. Anyway, so I sit through the meeting and I thank my friend, you know, for taking me there or whatever. I still didn't tell him the truth. I wouldn't tell him the truth until a year later, where I would go through a few more of these kind of periods of abstinence, where I was white knuckling it, and then I'd pick up, and then I'd white knuckle, and I'd go through that, and then finally, after the summer of '88, I was in a really, really intense working situation, and I didn't drink, and I got back into town, and I picked up like the day after I got back. And I thought, oh my God, here we go again. And then I thought, well, hopefully I won't pick up again until Thanksgiving or Christmas. And I think it was like 5 or 6 days later I picked up again. And then I picked up the next day. And then like 2 days later. And pretty soon it was like, I've likened it to that, the thing, the Sorcerer's Apprentice, where Mickey Mouse gets the broom and he trains it to, you know, kind of work for him, you know. And then it does too much work and so he stops it and he chops it up. And but then the broom comes to life and it becomes like 1,000 brooms or whatever it does, and it's, or mops, and it picks up dum dum da 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 dum da dum da dum. And it was like that's what I felt like. I thought I can't control this. I'm out of control. And so I went to a couple of AA meetings in earnest, and finally a guy who had been mildly, maybe not so mildly, 12-stepping me, got me. I went to this meeting in Greenwich Village, near where our apartment is, and I went, as I was walking across the village to go to the meeting, it's like those voices I was describing at age 14 had reversed. And the loud, rational voices that said, this is a great idea, you know, let's do this, let's party, on all that stuff, those voices had kind of gone cuckoo and crashed on each other, and the only thing that was left was the quiet voice in the back of my head, which was said, give this thing a shot. Ask the guy what the 90-90 is. You heard him say 90 and 90. What is that? Go find out. So I did, and he introduced me to my first sponsor. And right then and there, he was waiting for that moment, and he said, here's your sponsor. I said, sponsor? What do you mean? What's that? Anyway, this guy was my first of... I've had four sponsors in almost 24 years. I've been so, so lucky to have had the men in my life that have guided me and helped me with my recovery. Anyway, I had what I would call, and I've heard other people call it, a meeting-based sobriety. So I was going to meetings every day, and that white knuckling went away. Like, I don't know, within a few weeks, I didn't even notice. It was like a headache that I didn't have anymore. The obsession to drinking was just lifted. And I got really high on the unity / fellowship part of AA. And even when I was first counting days, somebody said to me, are you doing the steps, you know? And I said, yeah, I go to that step meeting on Tuesday night over. And I said, no, that's a step. Are you on a step? And I really didn't understand. I thought if you went to a step meeting, you were doing the steps. Anyway, I was a little cuckoo back then. But the reason I mentioned the steps, too, and I want to talk about this a little bit more, is that I really had... I felt like I went to another country and I had to learn a new language. And so the vocabulary of recovery was something that I really hadn't stepped into. I hadn't done a lot of what our founders talk about in terms of the one-on-one work with another alcoholic. I needed guidance one-on-one. I needed to be sitting down with someone with the literature, which I really had not been doing. My first sponsor tried to do it with me, and I was like thinking, oh, he's trying to give me some kind of therapy, but it's not professional, so what good is it? Finally, I started to hit the next wall in my recovery, which was I started to think that the meetings weren't really that interesting anymore, and that maybe I don't belong here. And I started to judge people, and I wasn't even aware that personalities had come in front of principles. I just wasn't aware of it. And fortunately, there was a guy who I'd seen him around. We were around each other a lot from when I counted days. And every once in a while, he'd ask me how I was doing, and I always said okay. But he wanted the real answer. You know, he didn't want me just saying, yeah, I'm fine, okay, see you later. He was probing, and you know, he ended up being my next sponsor, and I kind of had to fight to get him, because he was loaded. He didn't need another sponsee. And so when we finally sat down, I chased him pretty much, and because he said to me no when I first called him. I said no. He says, I can't, I have no room. He says, but I'll send you to a meeting where you can find a good sponsor. And I saw him again a couple of days later, and we sat down, and I said, no, you're the guy. I think I have to work with you. I'm desperate. And he said, okay, if that's the case, then, he said, are you willing to go to any lengths to recover from alcoholism? And I said, yes, I am. And I don't think I would have said that like that. I wouldn't have surrendered that deeply a couple years before that. But because I did at that time, and we started to sit down with the book, and we started to separate what one piece of literature was from another, and we read everything, the forewords, the preface, and went through Dr. Silkworth, Bill's story, went through all the steps. We went through all those chapters in the big book, and I did my step work out of the big book with him, with his guidance. And my life started to change. I didn't realize, like, you know, I had like this sort of shorthand for the steps, which was step one for me is about honesty. Step two is about faith. Step three is about hope. And I have to say, because this was mentioned, when Paul and Dave mentioned something about step three before we came over here. And in my step three, my sponsor said to me, he says, I want you to think about this before we do it. He says, do you want to go to some setting? Do you want to go to a church? You know, because we would meet in this diner at 7 o'clock in the morning, because that was his schedule. And I said, I don't care. He said, all right, well, says, we'll meet here. So we meet back at the diner the next week. He says, I want you to think about this, just like it says here. We thought about this before we went ahead and gave ourselves over to step three, as it's written in the book. Okay, fine. So I come back, and we kind of mumble step three, you know, over coffee in this diner on Hudson Street. And he says, now, just think about what we just did, and let me know how it goes in the days ahead. Well, I mean, like the next day, I was riding in our friend's car, and they have one of those roofs that open up in the ceiling of the car. And it was a nice day, and I opened up the roof, and it makes the car feel different. Light comes in, air comes in. I thought, God, maybe that's my mind. Maybe I can give my mind over to step three in that way. And then our daughter was like maybe months old at the time, and I had to get her to take a nap in the next day afternoon, and I was just rocking her like this, back and forth, back and forth. And that's how I used to get her to sleep, because I couldn't. I had to stand. I had to hold her and stand, and she, otherwise she wouldn't go to sleep. So she starts to. I could feel her letting go and falling asleep. And I went, and then it went from the neck down. I went, oh my God, I think I'm being held too, and that really got my attention. And then he had me do what I have my sponsees do, which is to go out and to talk to four or five people about their experience with step three and what it means in their lives. So I just wanted to sit on step three for a moment, because it was a crucial tool to my recovery. So which set me up, of course, for step four, which was self-examination work and what I've learned to call a greater call for honesty. And with four, I did the fear, the sex, and the resentment inventories, and I didn't know I was getting set up for what will be step eight later, but that's what happened. And in that step four, step five meeting, he says to me, he says, I know you're a veteran. He says, there's nothing in your fourth step about your experience in the war. I said, well, it's really not for AA. And he said, are you sure about that? And he's, you know, he was never in the service. I said, well, you know, let me think about it. And he said, no, he says, I think it's really important. He says, bring whatever you can bring, bring it here. And so we had like two sort of fifth step meetings. And step five is where I personally had my first experience with forgiveness. I really was lucky enough to feel that I had a piece of paper and a pen, and I thought, I want to write something. But there was nothing to write. I had done all the writing in four already. And I'd done this incredible, had this fifth step experience. But as I was sitting there, I thought, let me write something. And I wrote, Dear God, I did the best I could. And what I learned from that was that as an untreated alcoholic, I actually had done the best I could. And because of that step work thus far, I was able to start to take a little bit more of, I had more of an understanding of responsibility, of where to assign responsibility, where to take it, because I was kind of black and white with that. It was like, no, 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 it's all your fault. Or no, it's just me, I'm a piece of crap, blah, blah, blah. You know, and I started to make distinctions now, more and more. Six, to me, is about grace, because when I saw entirely ready, initially I thought, entirely ready? Oh, that means I make another decision. And really, in this alcoholic's case, it was not about making another decision. It was about aligning myself in this more intimate fashion with my higher power, that's what was going to happen, that's where this invisible relationship that was going to have an impact on my life was going to go into another zone. And from there, in terms of seven, that's where I could start to ask this force I call God to help me in my life, to take on whatever I was afraid of, or things that were complications for me, or in my case, things that were survival, behaviors or survival thinking that ultimately became character defects, and recovery became these blind spots that I really needed either guidance or inner guidance to help address. So character building in seven. Then with eight, I found myself back in the forgiveness theme again. It's like I'm looking at this list I had made of all these people that that I was going to have to revisit and make amends with. And before I could do that, I needed to look at one name at a time with my sponsor, with God, with this idea of forgiveness, because in some instances I needed to ask God to forgive me. I many times needed to forgive them. And then lastly, and most importantly, I would have to implore forgiveness from the other person. So those were the sort of three colors of forgiveness that were part of step eight. And then I had to carry out the amends. Step nine is where perceptions shifted. My perceptions of people and the world changed dramatically. So the language of recovery that is the step nine promises, they weren't just words that kind of looked really cool or had some energy to them. They started to have experience for me. And in my case, I had about 45, 46, 47 amends I had to make. And and part of those amends, too, I must say, was when I did go back and I had this sort of what I would call an appendix to my fourth and fifth step work, which was I went back and I talked to my sponsor about Vietnam, and I trusted him with information about that. And then we had a couple people on that list that were going to have to be dealt with. A couple of them were guys that I had served with. I just missed them. And the ramifications of eight and nine were so special, because I ended up... this is before the internet. I put an ad in what was called the VVA, the Vietnam Veterans of America, and had a newspaper, one in every state. And I put, for 6 months, I put this ad in of these guys. I just wondered what had happened to them. There was like maybe six names. Three of them I actually owed amends to. I owed serious amends to. The other three were guys I just wondered if they were still alive. And there was one guy on my list. He was the NFW. American way. Am I going to go back to that guy? You know, he was our commanding officer in this one unit I was involved in. And this was in the middle of my tour. And a couple of our guys tried to kill him. And I was connected with it. And he knew that. And they didn't get me on anything legal. The other guys went to prison. And they didn't even bust me. I stayed as a sergeant the rest of my tour. And I thought I got away with it. Well, fast forward all those years later, and I'm looking at this name, and as I'm doing amends, all of a sudden, some of these names that I haven't gotten to yet, the people are starting to look different to me. That's why I talk about this in terms of perceptions. These people didn't look the same to me as when I started out, when I just had the list. And so this guy, who I swore I would never go back to, because I thought this guy's a tyrant. And at the time, I was hoping they were going to get him. And I thought, oh no, I think I see, that's right, there's a God inside this guy. And I was actually starting to recognize that. And now I had some semblance of alcoholism in my life, and I saw how it was impacting even those times. So I found him. I find him in, he's way out in the Rockies there somewhere. And I just kept calling information, and I think I had remembered. I knew his name really because I used to forge his signature, too. So, they made me, of all things, I had this really difficult, challenging part of my tour, and then they kind of pushed me up into being the armorer and supply sergeant. And I was responsible for all this millions and millions of dollars worth of equipment, and so I was doing all this stuff for him, but. So I had a little bit of a. I remembered his name clearly, but I also remembered where he had grown up, and I was hoping I would find him. He was also older too, because if I was 19, he was 40, whatever. And then all of a sudden, I'm calling him in my 40s. He's 70. I don't know. Anyway, I finally I found what I thought was his name, and I called, and I got an answering machine, and I heard the voice, and I went, "Oh my God, that's him." And I couldn't leave a message. I just hung up the phone. And because I was cooking with still a little bit of the old resentment, a little bit of the humility, and a little bit and bits and pieces of this forgiveness. And I had prepared my amends with my sponsor in terms of if I did get a hold of him, what would I say? What would I not say? So so I get a hold of him like the next day, and I said, "Hi, Mr. This is Brian. I served in your company 1969, blah, blah, blah." And he said, "Well, there were a lot of guys." He said, I said, "I'm the guy that got the grenades." He said, "What do you want?" And I said, "Well, I'm calling because I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've had a chance to reflect on that time in my life. And I feel that I was behaving selfishly and fearfully. And I'm calling to see if you can forgive me, and I'll do whatever it takes to rectify the situation from as long ago as it was." And he was totally taken by surprise with that. And he said, I want to, you know, implore your forgiveness for any harm I may have caused you." And he said, "Oh, okay. Well, is there any harm I caused you? You know?" And I knew not to go there. That wasn't what the call was about. So he says, "So what are you doing with your life?" You know, I told him, "I live in New York City. I'm in the entertainment business, married, have a baby, blah, blah, blah." And he told me what he'd been doing. And then he said, we got to the end of the conversation, and he said, "Listen, if there's any harm I caused you, I hope you can forgive me." And I said, "Yeah, okay, sure." You know, he says, "If you're ever out here, this part of the country, would you come by? Well, maybe we can have some coffee." I said, "Yeah, sure." And I hung up the phone, and I couldn't move for 20 minutes. Because what had taken place in that interaction wasn't only the rewriting of history. I mean, my history of that situation was rewritten. And it was because of the template of what can happen in Alcoholics Anonymous and with the aid of higher power. And so I was really, really lucky that... that I had that kind of guidance to get me through that. And I have to say, that particular amends had like a trickle down effect in terms of male authority figures, which were at times problems for me. So I feel really, really fortunate. I focused a lot of my, when I get a chance to, I try and get into step nine work, because it really transformed my recovery and my life. And I had like a lot less glorious amends. I mean, because I was balking authority when I was at Rider University, and because I was an older student, I thought I didn't have to pay my parking tickets, and I thought I didn't need to have a parking sticker. So I had the back seat of my car. I had about maybe 100 of them, and they were piled up. And I used to leave them there for the security guards to see that I, you know, what a scofflaw I was, you know. And they would sometimes follow me around the campus and, you know, try and catch me. And they were older and stuff like that. So I was always dodging them, and I always felt really proud of that. And then, so my sponsor says to me, he says, "Why do you have a resentment down here for your college?" I said, "Oh, they're always hitting me up for money. You know, I'm always giving money to the alumni fund." And he goes, "Well, why are you doing that?" I said, "Well, because I didn't pay my parking tickets." He goes, "Well, pay the parking tickets. And then you don't have to give them any money if you don't want to." I never thought of that. I said, "Okay, let me pay my parking tickets." 26 years later, whatever it is. So I call Rider University, and I said, "I'm calling because I want to pay my parking tickets." And they said, "Oh, you need to be talking to someone in student life." I said, no, you don't understand. I graduated a long time ago, but I want to pay my parking tickets. I'm not giving money to the alumni fund." And they said, okay. So they turned me over to this person in student life, and they said, "You're not a student anymore." I said, "No, I know, but I want to pay my parking tickets. I can tell you how much it was, because I was keeping track of it." They said, "How much?" I said, $221 or something like that. "Oh, okay, well, you know what? You're not a student anymore, so we'll get back to you." I said, "Okay." So the next day they called me back and they go, "We have a great idea. You should just give the money to the alumni fund." So that's what I did, you know. So now if I send them anything, it's because I want to, not because I feel guilty or anything like that, you know. And then the last little amends story that is maybe worth telling, I guess, is that because there was a lot of, like, whatever violence in my childhood and stuff like that, when I was in kindergarten, down south of here, when I was in kindergarten, on the way home for lunch, I socked this other kid, really hard, and I didn't even look back. And then I heard that, you know, he had bled, and they had to take him to the doctors, and he wasn't in school the next day. And of course, I began to feel like a piece of crap, and the teacher said to me, "You know, you're evil. You know, you're just an evil kid. And do your parents know about this?" I said, "No." They said, "Well, you're going to tell your parents, right?" I said, "Yes, I'm going to tell my parents." And so, of course, I didn't tell my parents. But the teacher said, "Billy Murphy's been taken out of the school by his parents, and he's being sent to Catholic school because of Brian, the evil kid." So I get caught. My mother, my parents found out, whatever, like a month or two later at a parent-teacher conference. They were furious. And I had felt all that guilt for weeks piling up, because I knew they were going to find out sooner or later, but I wasn't going to be the one to tell them. So I'm talking to my sponsor, and I said, we're almost through most of my amends. And I said, "You know, this is going to sound really stupid, but I clocked this guy when I was 5 years old, and I've never felt good about it, you know." And he said, "Well, put it on your 8-step list and let's talk about it." So we had a conversation about it. I said, "You know what?" I said, "This is going to sound nuts, but I'm going to try and find this guy." And he says, "Okay, go ahead, you know." So I find him. I find, like, his parents. And I said, "Is Billy there? You know, did he?" We went to grammar school. We were in kindergarten together back in 1954 or something. And they said, "Really? Well, you mean William?" And I said, "Oh, well, yes, William. Where's William?" "Well, he lives over in wherever, was some other town." I said, "Could I call him?" And I said, "Yeah, sure." They gave me the number. So I called this guy up, and I said, "You know, I lived a couple blocks away from you. I'm Brian. I'm that kid that hit you, and then you know you got taken out of school. You went to that Penn Valley school, right? And he said, yeah, I went to that school. And then he said, then I went to Catholic school. I said, well, I'm the guy that hit you. I'm the guy that I'm the reason for that happening. And he said, he says, you know, he says, I'll tell you the truth. He says, I don't know what you're talking about. And I said, well, trust me, it happened. And I said, I'm calling because I've always felt stupid about it and guilty about it all these years later. And he said, hey, man, look, forgiven and forgotten, okay? And I said, okay, well, thanks for taking my call. I know this must sound crazy. He says, by the way, my brothers and sisters went to Catholic school too. I hope you don't think you sent them to Catholic school. Oh, anyway, we ended up on a lighter note with it. But it's I want to say a couple more things. I want to try and finish with this quote from Language of the Heart because there's not enough time to get through the rest of the steps like I'd like to. But I want to say that having a meditation and prayer practice and under the umbrella of step 11 is really, really a subtle but crucial part of an alcoholic's recovery. And it's really been interesting to me to see Bill Wilson write out how he wrote out step 11 in the big book and then how he writes it out in the 12 and 12 and then how he writes about it in this thing called Language of the Heart, which was a grapevine writing that he wrote in the late 50s. And to sort of see Bill talking about this with 20 plus years of recovery and program and where the program had come from and gone to and that kind of thing. Let me just jump to that. And a lot of times, you know, he would use third person to describe himself. And so he was always trying to objectify himself. Anyway, so he's talking about what he calls the doubter. And he says, our friend is clearly one who believes in some kind of God, God as he understands him, but he doesn't believe any bigger concept or better feeling about God to be possible. So he looks upon meditation, prayer, and guidance as the means of a self-delusion. Now, what can our hard friend, our hard-pressed friend do about this? And then he talks about doing meditation and prayer as an experiment to sort of see what happens. And so I'll just jump down a paragraph. It says, as he goes along with his process of prayer, he begins to add up the results. If he persists, he will almost surely find more serenity, more tolerance, less fear, and less anger. He will acquire a quiet courage, the kind that doesn't strain him. He can look at so-called failure and success for what they really are. Problems and calamity will begin to mean instruction instead of destruction. He will feel freer and saner. The idea that he may have been hypnotizing himself by auto-suggestion will become laughable. His sense of purpose and of direction will increase. His tensions and anxieties will commence to fade. His physical health is likely to improve. Wonderful and unaccountable things will start to happen. Twisted relations in his family and on the outside will unaccountably improve. Even if a few of these things happen, he will still find himself in possession of great gifts. When he has to deal with hard circumstances, he can face them and accept them. He can now accept himself and the world around him. He can do this because he now accepts a God who is all and who loves all. And I want to just close in the next couple of minutes and mention that in January, my wife and I went to Vietnam. And I had not been there in 42 years. And, I thought I'd made bits and pieces of peace with that place. And to tell you the truth, I'm not done. I work as an actor, I've said, so I have a piece of theater that I present. It's a one-man show about post-traumatic stress disorder and combat. And I've been doing it around New York and sometimes in Los Angeles. And so the government said I could do it over there for 20 minutes. That's it. And I did it in two places. The first place was in front of former Viet Cong and NVA, who were former enemy, and it was a total shock that they would even want to sit through it, let alone embrace it, which is what they did. And then for the next 3 hours, they couldn't stop talking about their own experiences. And there was a peace there and a kind of living amends that I don't know if it could have happened any other way. I must say, when we were in Saigon, we went to an AA meeting. It's really weird to see the pamphlets in Vietnamese, you know, but they're in Vietnamese. Then we were in a city called Hoi An where we were going out to visit different sites. And I had a situation where three quarters of the way through my tour, there was a time where I behaved very badly. And I beat up this Vietnamese man. You know, I almost killed him, and I was in some, like, blackout rage. And the guys with me just basically lit up cigarettes and said, yeah, he needs to get this out of his system. And we were all nuts. And we were in this hotel, in this dining room, and my wife and I were sitting there, and the busboy came by, and we made eye contact for a moment. And in that little space of a moment, like, the cylinders lined up, and I saw that guy from 1969. And he and I looked at each other, and I burst into tears. And I was—it was like an emotional tumor came up from deep down inside. I mean, and that's the—you know—whatever. That's the challenge and the blessing for this alcoholic and veteran is that these emotional tumors have risen to the surface, and the possibility for healing is beyond my imagination. And I'm not done. But the thing was, I saw this guy, and then of course I come back into the dining room later, and I look at him again, and we just smile at each other. But there was something in that moment that I could never have gotten had I not gone back there. And the government and the cultural ministers have invited me to come back, you know, later this year with the whole thing I do. And I guess we haven't put that together yet, but I believe I'm going to do it. And like I say, there were AA meetings over there, which really was like we were in the same town, Hoi An, and there was like two meetings a week. And the guy we called up, I said, I see you have AA meetings on Mondays, and he said, yes, we do. And I said, well, my wife and I would like to come to your meeting. What time is the meeting? And he said, oh, what time would you like it to be? I said, how 7 o'clock? He says, oh, we'll see you then. You know, so that was pretty funny. And then I just want to say, too, you know, I have a fantastic home group. It's called Room for Improvement, I mentioned before. And the notion of home has become something that's really, really important to me. And I'm going to close with a little quote about home and homecoming that I think would speak to all of us in terms of recovery. And let me just read it. Okay. One never comes home until one prefers a gentle heart to mastery over other lives. One comes home when one learns how to bring a gift and to receive one. When one is home, he or she gives love, makes comfort, hurts for justice. One is homeward bound when one is more tormented by the death of innocence and innocent children than by the frustration of ambition. One makes a home every time he or she allows a person to feel at home with their self. One is on the right road, not far away, close enough to run the last mile, when he realizes or she realizes that the greatest of all gifts to give another is home, and that the most surprising and wonderful gift to receive is homecoming. Thank you for my sobriety.